everybody, I know all these cool people, but you don't. So what we're going to do is, for our audience, please introduce yourselves, briefly describe the type of productions you've been typically working on, and maybe just one fun fact about yourself that no one knows. If you want, you know, Rob, we'll start with you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Robert Tonkin. I'm from Amazon MGM Studios here personally, but that's what I do all day. I'm head of prod tech engineering, and previous to that, I was at Evolution Media, where we produced Real Housewives of Orange County, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Vanderpump Rules, Botched, etc. That's what I do. Fun fact, born in Boise, Idaho. Was there for about 6 months, but that's what's on my passport forever.
Well, now I know.
Hi, my name is Shaheen. I'm an independent filmmaker, video editor, mostly in documentary. But I do have some corporate management experience, and at that point I was working commercials.
Sounds good.
My name is Tyler Marinello. I'm Senior Director of Production Technologies for Paramount Global, mostly focusing on legacy Viacom brands, MTV, Nickelodeon, Paramount Plus. I manage the support teams in New York, Nashville, Burbank, and Hollywood. Fun fact about me, I am from Buffalo and therefore have a giant chip on my shoulder.
And I'm Jeff Sankpiel.
Both are accurate.
CTO for Keycode Media, and I woke up this morning in Seattle. It was a long commute.
In his head.
What?
In your head.
No. I actually woke up this morning next to SeaTac. So right. It took a little bit of a commute to get here. All right.
Fun fact, that's my hometown too.
So. See, perfect. It all ties together. That's the whole point. Each of you represents different parts of the media and entertainment industry. Can you give me a high-level overview of what a typical show looks like for you from start to finish, capture to delivery? What aspects makes the productions you work on unique?
First, huh? Okay, so I work mostly in documentary, and I think the workflow there is continuous. It's not as a clear pre-production, production, and then post. We work with a lot of archival footage, and so we're doing a lot of mixed media. So there's a lot of technical troubleshooting of clips working in whatever editing software you're using, and just not having any hiccups along the way. Oftentimes we're starting the edit well before we have a story struck out. And so media management is really important. I think I'll pass it on.
Sure. So I was trying to think of whether I should talk about animation, marketing, or live production.
Sure.
I think I'm going to talk about live production just because we got one fan.
Is that your mom in the front row?
So at Legacy, our team is responsible for supporting a number of tentpole events around some of the Legacy Viacom brands. You know, things like the VMAs, BET Awards, NAACP Image are the ones we've done most recently. The next one up for us is Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards. From a high level, we're talking, it's every bit of a spectacle of an event. Mobile truck farm.
Slime,
you know, 20, 25 cameras doing a line cut that airs live in real time, mistakes and all. But there is a huge post-production footprint that runs parallel with all of that. Not necessarily the input to the show, but the output of the show and all the iterations, the international versioning, social media, things that live on, the evergreen version, all of which essentially requires us to take a 2.5 hour show and knock it down to 60 minutes. So that means you're starting out with terabytes of media all delivered in the blink of an eye, and turning it around in usually about 48 hours. So we have to have heavy duty infrastructure, heavy duty processes, trust, and a plan on how to get it all done. Because with that kind of timing, there's no room to screw up. And when we do screw up, we need to know how to adapt quickly.
And you get the international inserts in there too. I remember.
I think one of my like come to Hollywood moments was like, oh yeah, you can't do product placement for anything international. I guess they figured it out. Cool. Nice.
Scott Randall was able to join us. Scott works for Max Post. We're on to the, give me a high level overview of what a typical show looks like for you from stem to stern. Notice what I did there.
Typical show.
Yeah, stem to stern.
Stem to stern. Yep. I see what you did there.
Yep.
Max Post provides, is a Fremantle company. We provide post services for a range of companies, including Fremantle shows. So depending on the show, stem to stern, original productions, Deadliest Catch, 20th season, ton of footage, shot so remote that there isn't any other way to get it back than on a hard drive or on an LTO. No satellite connections up there, no, very little internet, cellular, all that.
Not a single luxury.
Yes. and a boat that, you know, might not come back in three hours. So we have that as one range. We do shows for 495 Productions, Jersey Shore Family Vacation, that has also been on for a long time. Those people are still popular 30 years, 20 years later. Yes.
Like that.
exactly. And then Fremantle does a number of game shows. Price is Right, Let's Make a Deal, other game shows like that. So we manage all of that. The systems, the processes were varied and different. But one thing for us is, you know, high volume, fast transcode, fast turnaround in a post. So automation is the name of the game. Standardization of naming and all of that is sort of what we do. And then, you know, we do online, we do mix. We've got a couple of feature documentaries in post right now. We did some of the post work, not all, not the finishing on a documentary that just dropped Netflix this week called Rather, about Dan Rather's illustrious career. And so we sort of run the gamut.
But it sounds like the core thing there is best practices.
Yeah. I mean, I had an email this morning from a production that's going to start shooting a documentary in France, and they were like, we're going to send you the footage. And I was like, great, here's our guide on how we want footage, and then we'll talk later about how we're uploading that and where we're getting that and what you're shooting. And yeah, if we don't talk about it ahead of time, you know, it's bad. Post starts when they start rolling,
right? Yes. So. Pretty cool. Robert.
Well, I was just going to say that I went back and looked at our presentation from last year just to like review, see our predictions. And I think in answer to this question, I think the trend is really that what were standard workflows within a facility, because last year we said, you know, what about remote? Well, remote is here to stay, is what we said last year. And I think the bigger trend this year is global. I think that you're seeing a lot more global productions, larger companies involved. That's really challenging our workflows from end to end, because you're moving a lot of media from place to place. And just putting on a plane is sometimes not practical. And so, you know, what do workflows look like going forward? I think they're going to be very different, similar in many ways. A lot of the standards-based things that you're talking about will continue, but I think we're really going to be challenged in how to integrate and orchestrate the media around the world as we continue to try and produce shows.
Very cool. So keeping you ahead of technology, it's something I've heard somewhere. it's actually Keycode's tagline. The process remains similar, but the workflow is always changing. What types of hardware, software upgrades, and services have you adopted over the last couple of years? Have any of these upgrades significantly changed how your team operates, or have they just been kind of incremental? I know you're all either going to say hybrid or remote. Tyler, let's start with you.
I couldn't agree more, Rob, that that remote is here to stay. We've seen no data to suggest otherwise, and I have a hard time believing that you can really like have a force the hand of creatives to tell them how that they should create. But yeah, just speaking for me personally, We have tried to lean into this is what the new work model is and curate around that, as opposed to this is the way that the standard broadcast engineer mentality from the 80s and 90s and 2000s of we're building these brilliant facilities, someone will come and use them, which is a shame because I love building big, beautiful things and hope that people use them, but I get tired of spending a lot of money and time and energy building a beautiful control room or edit room or machine room that never gets touched.
If you build it, there will be seats.
If I build it, there will be seats. To directly answer your question, yes, we've very much leaned into using tools like Teradici, HP Anywhere. We've also leaned into using a brokering tool called LeoStream, which was a little bit of a game changer for us because at the time, as this all was maturing in real time, we didn't really know how this was all going to go. We didn't know that Teradici was going to get bought by HP. We didn't know that eventually HP was going to start supporting Macs, and you know, support it for the Apple environment is crucial for the stuff that we do. But the bigger problem that we had was managing a pool of systems is crucial to keeping the lights on every day, because remote access, even though it's great that people can work in their pajamas and you're offering a higher quality of life thing, it has a number of inherent problems, and anything that we can do to round the edges around some of those problems is helpful. And LeoStream has been crucial to helping us get there.
I now have a mental picture of everybody in their pajamas.
Well, I was going to say too that I think LeoStream, one of the things we touched on last year was the trend towards, you know, higher levels of security. We've seen recently some attacks on some of the pals that are here. Our thoughts go out to them. I know that was probably horrible, but LeoStream introduces like a level of security that's like a next level. You know, you can now have two-factor authentication in front of your remote workstations. It doesn't have to run through a firewall, like through a third-party firewall piece. So that's definitely improving the situation and allow you to do a lot more volume. And I think the other thing is that I think when we had COVID, and even after you were in the post-COVID period, we were still using a lot of ad hoc solutions to do remote access. And I think that's all growing up. Like, we're now saying, okay, now we need like enterprise grade tools as well as we can get them into the hands of our teams.
And not to undersell our good friends at LucidLink, who have done, first people into the space, done a remarkable job. But being able to create the tool that helps you do the work is great. But the next step on the heels of that, especially when we're talking about the scale that we're talking about for enterprise organizations, is that level of security and reliability that comes from basically having studios as clients. Like, these are things that our information and content security teams demand. And it's nice to see these companies are starting to take that more seriously.
Shane.
It was very interesting to hear. What I remember from last year's panel is the conversation about AI and like how, you know, that was going to shift the industry. I think the thing that I've liked over the past year or a couple of years is seeing some of that get integrated into editing softwares. So Adobe is a great example. You know, I saw this year at the show also, Resolve has, you know, integrated some more automation features. All the nonlinear editing platforms now include script and text, which, you know, is great to have everything in one place. Camera to cloud obviously is like growing. I think Blackmagic released a new camera that has camera to cloud, right? Functionality, Praxis, I think. Yeah. And so I think that has been great for smaller, I guess, enterprises or smaller productions. And I think it's been pretty smooth. Like, once you get through the hump where you troubleshoot, it seems like the technology has been improving between last year and this year. That's how it feels.
Scott?
Yeah, looking back, I think last year when we talked, we have since really leaned into collapsing spaces, data center. You know, we were very large spread out. I think we were in two, maybe three buildings. Yeah, last year. Well, we're in one building now, and we'll
keep tracking that for you. Don't worry.
Thanks. We've tripled our footprint in our data center, and we're still in a push to move the remaining few clients that we have locally into that, into the data center. Security has become a big thing. I have a meeting with Fremantle Australia and Fremantle Nordics every other week, and it's basically talking about, you know, what are you doing security wise? What are, you know, how are you operating, so that we're all operating in the same manner and we're not open to any kind of attacks and stuff like that. And there was an unfortunate incident for Fremantle in Italy that wasn't a hack per se, but so it's out there, and we never really thought about it, I would say, before COVID, before remote, that kind of security. And so we've really been leaning into that. It's been one of our biggest trends, I think.
And you mentioned the AI, and one of the things I've seen recently in the last couple of weeks is a piece of software. So you've got the entire transcript of someone in, you know, doing their long introduction, you know, in a reality TV show, telling us all about themselves. It goes 15 minutes. Tell the software, give me a 3-minute version. And then you go back, that starts doing its deal, open up another sequence, tell it, give me a 4-minute blurb for social. The 3-minute version ends, and they come along and say, you know, it'd be better if she started that with a joke. Let's have her tell a joke at the beginning, go. Then the social version pops up, it gets sent, you go back and you look at the other thing, and it's like, no, she's not that funny. Just take it out, undo that. The cut's done. It's ready for delivery. A little bit of polish.
You make it sound so easy.
In watching it, it was easy. And it was like, wow, this is something that's going to basically take the space of a lot of story producers. Does that trim down really quickly? And that's here today, working inside of, it's a plugin into Premiere and also can work with Avid. So.
Well, I think it's natural that with the large language models that have been developed, that you're going to first see a lot of advances in transcription, translation, anything to do with words, because that's where they've really been trained. I think we're still in very much an uncanny valley level of reality in terms of visuals. Even the best examples that we've seen coming out of OpenAI, Sora, they look pretty good, but they have like their own, I guess I'm trying to figure out what I would describe it as, but they almost have like their own. Quoi. Yeah. It's like a style. Like they just look, I think we're going to look back in a few years and look back and say, wow, you know, you could really see the AI style, the machine learning basis of how these images were created, because they just don't look quite right to your eye yet. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Well, the other fun thing is they don't look quite right to you owning them. You make it, I can take it, I can sell it. There's no copyright in the United States on artificially generated images. Software doesn't own it. You don't own it as the prompt enterer. Tech people don't open it, don't own it. Gen AI today has no copyright. Please make it, let me know where it is, and I'll try to sell it. Because I can. Anybody can. That's part of the challenge. And we're going to need our friends in Washington to fix that.
Yeah, AI presents, excuse me, as I sit in a room filled with nothing but creative people, I want to be careful here. I made the joke the other day when someone asked what our strategy for AI should be, and I said, maybe we don't, but I don't think that's really realistic either. Like, at the end of the day, this is an advancement in technology. Smart leaders will follow this and then figure out how to steer the ship. There are a lot of exciting tools that are out there. A lot of us are aware of the more popular ones. I feel like I learn about a new tool every week. I think the thing that's important to me is the type of media that I like to consume, that I like to enjoy. The part that makes me really enjoy it is when I feel like I've got some kind of personal connection to the story. There's a person that I'm rooting for, a scenario that I want to see happen. I want to see Thanos defeated. Like, you know, whatever.
Screw that guy.
But the reality is that, like, part of the reason why we have those types of connections is they're made by people. And nobody ever makes a film by themselves. It's usually lots of people that are working collaboratively, which is part of the draw and part of the reason why we're all here. I think AI is a tool set, using very many air quotes there. There are ways that we can save on time and save on money, and that's valuable, and we should explore that, and we should be responsible with it. But if we get to points where we think we're losing our creative spirit, I think we've lost.
The panel after this is actually going to be about AI and machine learning and all that fun stuff, so you can stay after this one and see all the robots. Who here in the audience went to NAB, made the trek to Vegas?
How many steps did everyone take?
Yeah.
5,000? Higher than 5? 10,000?
25?
We're doing a little Price is Right for you.
Exactly. Price is Right rules.
Plinko.
Yeah. So most everybody here went to NAB. What are the cool things you saw? And do you think NAB in Vegas is still relevant going forward? Robert, we'll start with you. We'll just go down this way.
I thought NAB was an incremental show. I thought in general, the theme was just generalized progress. I think, you know, relative to the previous year, you know, maybe the supply chain had freed up a little bit. So we saw a lot more hardware coming out. I think one of the coolest things that I saw was the Sony dual frustum through the switcher, virtual production environment. I thought that was very exciting.
I was going
to
say.
Oh, sorry, man. It's okay. So you get to go first.
No. I'm sorry.
No, I thought it was great because it basically used, you know, you had your composite image that was virtual production with switching on the frustum, camera switch back and forth. And then you had a ghost frame recording as well that was also being dropped into a recorder so you could later replace content. I thought that was great. I think the other piece that I thought was really cool was just like little things. Like I thought a lot of the little mini cameras, a lot of the SDI cameras, a lot of the NDI cameras were amazing, especially for reality. And even there was a camera on a track, basically a mobile track that you could basically take into a stage, and it worked through standard protocols to control it, to move your camera up and down. I thought that was fantastic.
So Ghost Frame is, you got the LED background, and while it's got certain things for certain cameras, there's one camera that is in a different sync pulse with the actual wall. It's possible to have still cycling through even at a 60 frame rate, 4 or 5 different images that are popping back here that are in sync with those cameras. Each camera sees its own image. If you look at it as a human, it gets a little blurry.
Yeah, it looked pretty darn good. That I think that was partly why it was amazing. And yeah, that Ghost Frame basically is a green screen version of what the camera is filming. So it's simultaneously recording green screen and it's getting your composite ICVFX shot.
Yep. Shaheen, what'd you see?
Okay, well, as a video editor, I always go to Avid, Resolve, Adobe. Those are my first stops. I think the Blackmagic display or their booth, both what they've released with their cameras, their camera to cloud functionality, and then the automations in Resolve, just really make it a very attractive brand as an independent filmmaker. You know, their price points are pretty affordable, and the quality is really high. So I think that really stood out to me. And then in terms of, I think cameras, I look for smaller content, stuff for documentary, things that I can, that are portable. And Fuji, I think, had some fun, smaller, but robust cameras. The H2, I think, that just came out. And then there's another model. They do camera to cloud. They're integrated with Frame.io. You know, have long battery life. And that's what I'm excited. I think now that I've moved from a corporate management position to being a creator again, so much technology has developed in the past 3 years that I had the opportunity to learn while being at, you know, larger enterprise establishments. But I think those tools have come along so much in the last 3 to 4 years that now as an independent filmmaker, I feel like they're accessible to me. So I think for the last 3 years over NAB, that's the growth that I've seen, is that, you know, tools that I got to use that were more proprietary or in their early stages have now worked out a lot of kinks and are affordable and accessible.
They've matured.
Yes.
They've reached market penetration. Scott, what'd you think?
It was interesting. This year I went on my own. There's corporate travel ban at Fremantle still. So I said, well, I'm still going to go. But it gave me a chance to sort of look at the show in a different way and sort of not take a bunch of meetings and with vendors and just sort of wander around. And there were some pretty interesting, you know, kind of niche things, people in little corner booths and that were interesting. I still think it's relevant, the show. Maybe not. I mean, I think it lost a lot of ground, right, with COVID, and then it's coming back and they keep changing halls and locations, and they're still the, you know, North Hall's.
They're just redoing the whole convention center. Yeah, it was South Hall last year and North Hall this year.
Yeah, so it's all a little bit still in flux. I think next year will be really interesting to see how it goes. There were a couple of neat little... One thing I saw was a company that would take your footage, create a 3D model of the person in the shot, basically with the purpose of relighting them. You could change out the background, but their gear wasn't that great. The main purpose was to, you know, take the existing lighting, map it onto the new 3D model it made of that person, and then relight the scene, which was interesting. Little small company. Another really cool thing I saw, I didn't see at the show, I saw at HPA actually, was an AI software that would work on our existing internal storage and Avid Media. Didn't have to be proxy, didn't have to be a specific codec. It could look at all of that. And then you could do image search, text search. Really cool.
It was called?
Kino AI.
So, find something else since you got swiped?
Yeah, something didn't get swiped. So, just from the heavy hitters, like, I'm impressed with what Black Magic is doing with Resolve, and I'm impressed with the camera platform that Rob was describing. The reason I get out of bed to go to NAB and have my feet hurt by the end of it is because I want to be inspired. And when I walk by a certain hardware manufacturer and they've got 10 pieces of printed signs in their booth, and every single one of them has a phrase with the word AI in it, it's like, okay, I get it. It's marketing. We're all marketing. But like, okay. And so the question about NAB still relevant? That was a low point for me, because I'm like, working for a big company, if I want to get in the room with a major manufacturer, that's usually something we can achieve. For smaller, more independent people, I understand the lift there, but again, hard to be inspired by just, you know, some of these incremental changes, like Robin pointed out. But one thing that absolutely, it was the last thing I saw, and it was what actually left me hopeful. Any science fiction fans out there? Anybody like Star Trek? That's the right answer. There was a panel, if any of you guys were there, maybe you guys sat in it. There was a panel with a futurist who used to work for Paramount, who I don't know, and a handful of other people talking about the integration that Octane worked on. Not Octane, what's the name of the parent company for Octane? Whatever. There was a software company that worked with Apple to develop essentially the bridge for each of the different Star Trek ships inside the Apple Vision Pro. And I knew about this. I was like, okay, that's cool, whatever. I haven't used an Apple Vision Pro. We've had some internal discussions about, is someone going to try to edit with this thing? And if they do, should we at least understand how to use it? And, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a joke, but like, you know, we kind of are keeping our eye on it. So when I saw there was a seminar, I dragged a bunch of my team with me, and I was like, we should just kind of hear what this has to say. It might be cool, right? the conversation was about half of what I just described, talking about what it took in order to take this legacy footage and build a model around it so that it could be inside of the Apple Vision Pro. Okay, cool. The rest of the discussion was, how far away are we really from building a real life holodeck? And I gotta be honest with you, I was like, you wanna do what?
Yep. I'm down for that.
And there were some people who asked some smart questions. It's like, how do you get haptic response from something in three-dimensional space when you're very far away from essentially a panel? And I encourage everybody to go. It was recorded. I encourage everybody to go and look at, because I don't know that it's something I'll ever get involved with, but I walked out of it thinking, this is cool as hell. And this is exactly why I do what I do.
See, that makes it worthwhile. So one key note. There were 1,300 exhibitors at NAB. 180 of them mentioned AI. Yeah. 180. So it wasn't.
That's kind of downplayed a little bit, don't you think?
Yeah.
No. I think you know, I've been to a couple, like at HPA, there were a couple vendors. I'm not going to say who, but basically, you know, a lot of it is kind of magic beans, like Jack and the Beanstalk. Like, oh yeah, like, hey, look
at
this.
That's a good analogy.
It's just. By magic, can search through all of the content and decide what was a good scene and what was a bad scene. You're like, no, it can't. I mean, and I think that at NEB, they definitely did not bring those out because they knew that they would be called out, I think. But yeah, it was a light AI show.
And the other thing also that I saw, anybody from Avid in the room? Round Trip Media Composer to Pro Tools. They're showing it. Oh my God, it's only been 20 years. All right. Oh, darn, those are recording back there. Industry trends. So a year ago, when we had this show, it was day one of the writer's strike. So it started a challenging time for creative teams and production all across Southern California, which rippled into everywhere, New York, Canada. It's been an interesting adventure. Where do you think we are in terms of recovery from that period? What ways has the industry changed due to that? And what of those changes do you think is going to leave a permanent mark?
Let's start with you.
Right, me again.
Yeah, we'll okay. Go this way.
I don't think we've recovered. I think layoffs have continued, and that indicates that the industry is still reeling, both from economy and maybe from shifts caused by the strikes. I am trying, as you know, when I read that question and as you mentioned it, I really am trying to think of a silver lining of just like in moments of strife or difficulty, I generally find that art is outstanding and the most creative, but I can't say that that's necessarily the case in content creation. So I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what other folks actually have to say about that.
So what? One quick question on that. Who here has worked on a pilot this calendar year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
two
says it all.
For those at home.
Yeah,
that
says it all.
I didn't realize there was a second hand. I only saw one hand.
Wow, I saw one hand too.
Five. Pilot.
Yeah. Well, something that's being created for spec to try to sell to a network.
I mean, they don't necessarily do a pilot anymore. It could be just a 20-minute
teaser. Yeah.
Or proof of concept.
Yeah. Anyone work on anything like that? A couple more hands.
You got the five.
So, yeah, the development pipeline is not cooking right now.
It's dead.
I mean, I was going to say risk. The mood, I think, also at NEB was kind of tampered by the fact it's a very risk-averse environment. I think the cost of capital right now is really...
I couldn't agree more. Like, I feel like the risk tolerance for everybody, when money was cheap, everybody looked like a genius. It's like, well, you know what? We're going to spend $100 million on content because it's what we need to do. It's important to flood the pipeline. And now that interest rates are so high, it's like, man, wouldn't you be careful? It's like, we're going to pick our spots.
Circumspect.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree that the impacts from the writer's strike are still prevalent. There's obviously, I remember I was taking my car to get in to get an oil change, and I walked in three different places, a coffee shop, like a UPS store, and a place to get a sandwich, all within maybe a half a mile of each other. And I ran into three different people all having conversations about the impending strike this summer. And I'm like, it's, again, I mean, it's not that I didn't know what was happening. It's just that it's front of mind on everybody, for everybody. And not that I necessarily blame them. It's hard. I don't know that, speaking for myself, I don't know that anybody is really over the anxiety of that, myself included. I'm hopeful that there is a contract on time. Again, speaking for myself, but you know, the hope is that cooler heads prevail around all of this stuff, and we get to go back and make content. We get to make stuff that we're proud of, that we get to work hard on. You know, short of that, it's a little bit twisting in the wind.
Definitely. Robert?
Well, I think the trend continues with small creators and influencers driving a lot of the industry progress. I think you have a lot of money in this space, which is now driving audience, which is now audience that used to be being picked up by networks or streamers or whatever. I mean, you know, if you ask, basically there are two, is for my daughter, there are two forms of entertainment. One is sports, and the other one is Instagram streaming videos. And, you know, she doesn't have TikTok, but TikTok would be there if it wasn't. So I think that that's putting a lot of pressure on, you know, the eyeballs are watching those things. But that doesn't mean there isn't a lot of interesting creative stuff going on in those spaces. And I think we're going to see, you know, that generation of editors and people who've been creators and kind of creating graphics, creating storylines, creating promos, doing the marketing. How, as those folks come up into the greater industry, it's going to be exciting to see what they do.
Yep. The largest solid state shared storage array in existence is owned by a YouTuber.
Yeah.
Scott, what do you think?
Yeah. It's interesting because the strikes obviously don't affect most of the shows that we provide posts for, reality shows. And we're coming into this quite busy period, actually. June, July, we're going to be, you know, everything's going to be full online, offline. But there are a lot of things that sort of indicate that we're spending a lot of time getting all our old stuff into Fast Channel, you know. And so it's like, we're not going to spend money to make these new shows, because like you say, it's risky, but we're going to go back and we're going to take, so right now we're looking at AI and things to get standard def shows up, because no one will watch standard def anymore, I'm told. So, you know, and the other things that we've been doing are self-funded, to get to just move things forward, you know, production, some of the production companies that we work with, they're like, we're funding this, and we're hoping it's going to sell at the end. And but overall, yeah, I mean, I think it's still bad. I understand, but for most of us, our companies, it's because they're reality based. We're not as affected.
That's one of the trends I'm seeing as well. Restoration and old content. There's tools out there that are now using generative AI. So say you've got a chunk of film that got garbled. There's 7 frames that are missing. Just makes it. It just makes it, and it looks like it's supposed to be there. You got a chroma crawl on an old video, you know, something that was recorded back in the day, and you need to fix that. They can fix that. So there's a lot of draw for that content to just reprint money with what we've already got. And then there's also the Suits effect. You hear about that? So... literally, I spent this morning on an airplane, and, you know, I paid for the Wi-Fi, and, you know, I'm scrolling through reels on Facebook. Every third one is Suits. I'm interested. You know, I might go and watch the show.
But also it's delivering in 16 by 9 little chunks with captioning on it already. So it's now drawn me into wanting to possibly go and binge the show. And that sort of a thing, it's like it's existing content for them. That, you know, there's no cost for it.
It was one of the largest, biggest stream shows.
Yeah, last year.
Yeah.
Because the marketing, the social media marketing worked out so well, and it's still working out so well. And it gets into your algorithms and then you just keep seeing.
Well, free ad-supported television is like, it's basically television. I mean, it's a streaming channel that is basically TV. And somehow Samsung has figured out how to lock my TV into only showing the Western channel every time I turn off my Apple TV. So there's somehow like Westerns always going on my TV, which came from somewhere and was up-resed. And maybe it's being mechanically up-resed or something. But yeah, that's you know, hundreds of channels just sitting on the TV that most people probably don't even hit.
Yeah, fast channels are everywhere. And it's really easy to spin them up. They're, you know, technology-wise, that's not a big ask. Future. So if you pull out your crystal ball, what does the future hold for, you know, your production crews and your teams? What type of things are you currently working on that you think are going to go forward into the future? And what new things do you think are on the horizon? Scott, we keep ending with you, so we'll start with you.
I don't know that I have a good answer for that, though.
Which is a good answer. I mean,
yeah. I mean, what are we looking at? What do we talk about every day? Increasing things like archive. We need, you know, more and more content coming in. This is an old line, but it's more relevant. I think, you know, more and more content coming in, more and more of it needs to be archived, more and more of it needs, because it's all going to get, you know, pulled back and reused later. And how are we moving all of that and leveraging that? And are we DRing it all? And, you know, these are the conversations that we have weekly, basically. So that's a trend, I would say, for us. And how are those things, you know, we're meeting with a company that does the, you know, here's all the footage that you shot, you know, find me a story about Joe and put it together and then, you know, let me watch it. And so that's, what does that do for our teams? That eliminates story producers, that eliminates loggers. How does that look? And then how do we set ourselves up for the people that are coming up that have, you know, been working in social media there since they were kids? And they're like, this, you know, NLE is very clunky. It's, you know, how come I can't do this? How come I can't do that? How do you sort of gather those people into, because they're the next thing, right? So how do you gather them into what's sort of always been a traditional post workflow?
Yep, it's adapting. Robert, what do you think?
The future. I think that the most exciting thing that's, I hope, is coming is that we move from kind of a tools-based machine learning AI things where you have like noise reduction being done by machine learning models or color noise reduction, like in picture, to really some tools that partner with the creators. I mean, I think that really can assist. I mean, that piece is, I'm not convinced that we've seen, you know, really true, and we're not seeing true creation. We're seeing replication and a grab bag of choices. You know, if there are 10 pictures in this box, let me pull out one. Does this look like what you're looking for? I mean, that's kind of the way it feels. And I think that really, you know, in the same way that maybe we've worked with partners, you know, in the edit bay, or maybe it's even a sketch artist, where you can basically like be working on storyboards, you know, if that can suddenly be in consultation with the creator to execute the creator's vision in a way that's seamless. I think that that's the part where the humans are still in control. The humans are still driving the creative decisions. But some of the mechanical work is being done by machine, which is what we use every day. That's what this thing does, but this thing basically just retrieves information and shows it to me.
It's kind of the natural evolution of this sort of stuff. I mean, the idea being there's a person with their hand on the steering wheel, but we're letting the car drive itself for as much as it can. You know, look, and as for efficiency, a lot of these AI tools are great because guess what? If a job that used to take 4 hours now takes 10 minutes, it means I've got 3 hours and 50 minutes to go and do other stuff. So maybe I'm delivering faster. I'm delivering more. I get to work on multiple projects. You know, I'm hoping it kind of opens up those kinds of opportunities.
You certainly have extended the capabilities of creators, and they're doing things that they wouldn't have done anyway. Like they, you know, they're now able to do things like mastering or make certain, you know, noise reduction things that they probably weren't going to be able to do. But now with a plugin or a tool, they can implement those, whether it's, you know, but for the higher end things, like for the, you know, large scale productions, like there are these tools really at the professional grade yet? I'm not sure that they are. And where you're going to put all your trust in them. So I think we'll see if it ever gets to the automatic. I don't think the self-driving, I don't like that model for our industry, but I think, you know, creatively, hopefully we can partner with some of these tools and technologies.
Jane, what do you think the future?
The future. Well, I think social media content is here to stay for sure and is going to grow. I think a lot more storytelling is going to happen on that platform. I think to your point, a lot of marketing is successful on Instagram, on the 9x, or I guess the 1x1s. So I think for myself, like as someone who is now back in the creator's seat, I feel like this is a great time. I think that the future for me holds a lot more autonomy and independence to create the stories that I want to and tell the stories I want to. And I think that's true for a lot of young, you know, content creators today who are going to grow into, you know, professional editors at bigger homes. Like they're coming with tools and experience in telling short form stories with them at the center of them. I think those are my two big predictions for the future. The other thing I think about actually is, so, you know, the resolution capability of cameras just keeps increasing every year. It's like, how pixelated do we need to get? And I think, you know, for myself, like I'm very happy in HD. I was filming abroad. And I was trying so hard to take film with me because I love the way that looks. And it's time tested, you know. But every time I go to a show or every year, there's just like a stronger camera with more resolution. And, you know, I'm like, what drives that? And my guess is like sports and surveillance. I feel like those feel like two relevant spaces that need higher pixels. And then that makes me think, I guess, going to maybe your point earlier around like regulation, right? Like how is this stuff around like data and security and AI tools that kind of bridge between entertainment and surveillance, you know, like how is that going to get regulated?
That ends up being a discussion I have with a lot of clients where, okay, it does all this resolution, but you're only delivering in HD. Sometimes you're delivering all the original content media, all the original camera media to the deliverable as well. Because at some time in the future, they're going to use new tools that are out in 5 to 10 years from now to do something completely and utterly different. And they want that resolution, despite the fact we've only delivered 1080 out of it today. Or you've got some people who, you know, like Fincher, he shoots 6K, delivers 4K, but he's always moving things around. He wants it for a creative concept.
Yeah, I understand that for sure. But on large scale, we still have to store that somewhere. We still have to build infrastructure for it. And I don't know, it's just growing and more powerful. And I do wonder how we'll manage that as we think about like conservation and, you know, environment and control, I guess, of data.
Well, that's also the other interesting thing, an AI search versus a Google search. The amount of power it draws is ridiculous compared to what we've been doing. So the other thing in the long term is going to be, what is the inherent cost there for, you know, data centers.
Yeah,
you know?
The environmental impact for all of the AI data centers is absolute murder.
It's going to be huge. So we're going to get to future for you in a second, but just got to make a note that the camera you mentioned, the Praxis, it's the Klingons Key Energy Production Facility.
And it was did not destroyed. Catch that. Yeah.
What do you think about the future now?
Unclear. Just to piggyback on Shaheen's point, like for me, like what I hope the future holds, there's very clearly like a, I don't want to call it a glut because I don't necessarily think there's a problem with it, but there is a great amount of content that is consumable from your phone that you're happy to consume from your phone, and the quality you are consuming it from your phone, the quality you you see while consuming it from your phone is acceptable. Mm-hmm. It's not whether I agree with it or not. It's popular. There's the top three apps on the App Store are all social media platforms, all talking about this. At the same time, my hope is that there is that continued drive towards innovation, because I love watching high-end concerts. I love watching the Super Bowl. I'm a sports fan. I love the idea of being able to, as much as it infuriates me and you realize that refs do a really good job, except they missed the thing that was off by 1 millimeter, because now we can literally, you know, instant replay technology is so good. As much as that's infuriating, the fact that we're still driving that kind of innovation is inspiring to me. The spectacle aspect of what we do, I hope that that does not get lost in the rush to just create more stuff.
Okay.
But at the same time, in all of that scrolling that I was doing on an airplane, mm-hmm. looking at garbage video, basically, every five or six things
mm-hmm.
was an ad. So ad supported is back. It's going to it's going to drive the streaming industry into profitability. It's just going to take a while to get there, because remember, we went through this model with music. Remember?
Yep.
Napster?
MTV.
Yeah. Napster. Napster. We all stole everything. And then the iPod came along. And we decided we wanted it in better quality, and we began to pay for it and had no problems with it. So that's what will happen in video with streaming.
Right. I think the one other thing that I see happening is Lucidlink was first, but to get into that space, but there are a number of competitors who are all doing cool and interesting things with remote or hybrid work here to stay. Like greater penetration into that market seems inevitable.
Yep, definitely does.
One other thing I was just going to say, like in terms of the spectacle, I totally forgot about this, but basically, you know, we've been in an era where people are watching movies on screens that are higher resolution, higher color quality, and higher, you know, potentially higher frame rates if you don't turn that feature off. Versus using, you know, seeing it in the theater. So the theater is very dark. It's not bright. The contrast ratio is off. But some of the direct view theater screens, like the Culver Theater in Culver City, which is top next door to our space, but there are direct view LED screens. And I saw the Taylor Swift documentary on that, and it was spectacular. I mean, it was the spectacle with Dolby Atmos sound, Dolby Vision color. I mean, it's amazing. And so I don't think those are going to go away. I mean, I think the filmmakers are going to push it, the mixers, but you know, now you can go to a big space and see it at the same quality you see at home. That's kind of wild.
Or a quality that surrounds you entirely.
Yeah. True enough. That's the holodeck is coming.
The holodeck's in Vegas. It's 36 stories tall.
If anybody has the chance to go to the Sphere, I highly recommend. It was a very memorable experience.
And this panel was also a very memorable experience. Thanks to our panelists today. Thanks to you for all coming out. We're going to be talking about AI on the next panel. So please stay tuned for the robots. Bring new capture photos.
Thanks for watching Broadcast to Post. Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast to receive future episodes. Follow Keycode Media on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to receive news on additional AV, broadcast, and post-production technology content. See you next time, folks.